Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Natalia Molina on the show. Dr. Molina is a distinguished professor and Dean's Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Her influential research examines the interconnected histories of race, place, gender, culture, and citizenship. An award-winning author, teacher, and mentor, she has written three acclaimed books: How Race is Made in America, Immigration, Citizenship, and the Historical Power of Racial Scripts; Fit to Be Citizens, Public Health and Race in Los Angeles, 1879 through 1940, and most recently, A Place at Nayarit, How a Mexican Restaurant Nourished a Community. The Los Angeles Times called A Place at Nayarit an essential Los Angeles book. It was a finalist for a James Beard Award and received 14 awards and honorable mentions from various organizations. The book chronicles the lives of immigrant workers, including Molina's grandmother, who became placemakers, nurturing and feeding their communities at restaurants that served as urban anchors. Professor Molina is currently working on a new book, The Silent Hands That Shaped the Huntington Library, A History of Its Immigrant Workers. Named a USC 2023 Communicator of the Year, she has written for the LA Times, Washington Post, San Diego Union Tribune, and elsewhere. In 2020, she was named a MacArthur Fellow. It was such a pleasure to talk to Dr. Molina, and we cover a range of topics, including all three books mentioned and much more. Please enjoy our conversation. So Dr. Molina, can you talk about both the opportunities and challenges for academic historians to write popular books? How is popular writing viewed within academia?
That's a great question. And I think even my gut instinct to that response says a lot, which is that it's a question that we don't even really think about until you write your second book. It's just not assumed like something that you would do, because we need our first book to get tenure. And so you are so steeped into, you write a dissertation, that dissertation is turned into a manuscript, that dissertation as a manuscript is vetted by presenting at conferences, i.e. to scholarly audiences, by presenting at invited talks, i.e. at universities to scholarly audiences, and then will be published with an academic press, because that will show that it is unbiased. You get readers' reports. And so you're still operating in this universe. And then once you are tenured, you have the privilege to look up and say, oh, wait a minute, who do I want to be speaking to? By then, you are so trained in your academic habits that it is difficult to write a public-facing book, not only because you have not been skilled in how one finds an agent, how one writes in this manner, but all your networks, everything is all about that kind of academic audience. I think for me, it was a little bit different because I had the opportunity to do a training with the op-ed workshop, the op-ed project. And so I did it not quite knowing what I would write about. And they said, you have a year after this workshop that we'll pair you up with a journalist in order to vet your op-ed and help you write one. And everybody else had come into the workshop with something they wanted to write. And I had not thought that far forward. And I thought, oh gosh, I'm going to squander this opportunity. And then one day I wanted to write about something. It came to me. I wrote it in one sitting. I shared it with the journalist and they helped me massage it. Basically put the end at the beginning, right? I'm a historian. So by the time I wind up, I'm at the end and get to my point. I'm at the end. They're like, yeah, it's an op-ed. You start with that. And that really started to change my scholarly voice.
And part of the thing is for me, and I don't work in academia, is there's so many interesting people that I read in that space, and I want them to engage with the public more. That's my desire. academic solutions to real world problems is something that I've heard used quite a bit. And I would love to have that engagement be more active across a wider range of faculty and universities. And I wonder, do you think it's something that maybe could be a part of a PhD curriculum to think about ways to engage with the public? How would you think about the best way to do that if you were to engage academics in that capacity?
The other part of that answer to your first question is that we already are doing so much of that. So part of what we do in our work is what we call service. So most people picture university professors as you're quote unquote working when you're in the classroom. But you're working when you're in the classroom, when you're preparing your lectures, when you're on committees, when you're doing your research and your writing. But the committee part is actually pretty big, what we call service. And that service takes lots of forms. It could be the kind of ins and out operations of the universities, serving on tenure and review committees, but it could be working with nonprofit organizations. Right before I got on this podcast, I opened my email to pull up the link for it. And I had an invitation to serve on a committee for the country's 2026 anniversary. And there's a lot of ways in which we are being trained in that. And I think one thing is to actively realize you can make your service commitments more about that. One of the other things that I was fortunate to get into very early on in my career is working with K through 12 teachers. And that was a two-way street where I would get invited to teach in summer workshops for continuing credits, that kind of thing. But teachers, K through 12 teachers, have no time to mess around as they are constantly working, constantly teaching. And so they want to get those lessons and make them applicable right away and make them interesting to their students. And so they're constantly asking, how do I use that now? What is a primary source that I could use? How do I make this relevant to them now? And so I ended up learning more from them in terms of those kinds of questions and just viewpoints. Mm-hmm. And so that alone makes a huge difference. I think also, you know, this is going to sound, I think, surprise a lot of people, but just because you're a university professor and you have to teach, you can be shy in public and speaking to public audiences. It's not what people are most comfortable doing, but doing those kind of K through 12 workshops, speaking at public events to more public audiences make a difference. I just did an interview yesterday for CNN, and the reporter is looking at these TikTok videos. If you haven't seen them, you must look them up after you finish listening to this podcast of an influencer named Jose, who does a podcast where he goes up to Mexican workers, be they street vendors or day laborers, and he pays them for their time or their goods that they're selling, and then gives them their time back by saying, okay, now I've paid you for how much you would make in the next hour or the day. Let's go to Disneyland. Let's give all the fruit that you're selling away. And there's just so much joy in that. And so she had contacted me and said, I'm looking for someone to interview about this. Would you be able to recommend someone? And she's interviewed me before. And I'm like, I would love to talk about that. It to me is doing, this influencer is doing in their TikToks what I feel I'm doing in my written work, or at least what I try to do, is to make them visible, in this case, people's labor, and to do something that we can't always show by only looking at archival materials, was that immigrants live three-dimensional lives, including with joy and glee and whimsy and delight. And I love that he's able to show all that. And so she said, okay. And I guess I wrote such a forceful email. So she said, sure, I'll interview you. And then we were done. She goes, it's just, there's so many academics who don't like to talk about popular topics. And so imagine all we're missing out on, right? Because when I see that, I can also historicize it. I can talk about why day laborers might be apprehensive when someone comes up to you and says, hey, I'd like to pay you for your time, but we're going to do something a little different today. So there's a lot of ways in which we're missing out by academics not doing that, and that we as academics can grow by becoming more public facing.
Let's talk about another part of public facing, which is the industry that you are adjacent to. USC has an amazing film school. You're down the road from Hollywood. And I know you've done some work advising in Hollywood on historical accuracy. This maybe sounds like a loaded question, but how concerned is Hollywood with historical accuracy in your experience?
I'm not telling you this story to name drop. It's just the first story that comes to me, which is I had the privilege of working on the Perry Mason show, the second season. Mm-hmm. And that one had more of a Latino history focus. And so they asked me to come in and work with the writers on the season. And it is not a historically accurate show, right? It takes what in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in LA, direct at Latino communities, such as the raising of Chavez Ravine, the once Latino multi-ethnic neighborhood that then the land is used, it was supposed to be used for public housing and is instead used to build Dodger Stadium. It combines just a lot of different elements in history and kind of compresses them into a couple of years in the 1930s. And the writers weren't necessarily interested in accuracy, but they were interested in nuance and depth. And so while they didn't focus on going year by year, they did ask for reading lists. They did ask for a lot of opinions on how I saw how they were interpreting events. And then I was invited onto set. And the first day there, I met Matthew Reese. And considering I'm a huge Americans fan, I was so excited. And he said, and they introduced me as one of the historical consultants. And he said, oh, are you the one that's making sure that we're getting the history right? And I said, I'm the one who is helping make sure that when you read a part, read a script, that it has the depth and nuance and humanity that your acting skills deserve. Granted, I was a little starstruck. I went a little overboard, but it was true, right? Like for me, it was less important that when they're talking about a baseball stadium being built, that it's actually something that's happening in the late 50s and yet they place it in the 30s, than why Latinos would have a complicated relationship to this space. To me, it was more important to show that Latinos had a certain limited social mobility because of the racial scapegoating that went on in the 1930s, rather than show actually the Depression happened here and repatriation happened during this time. And so in that sense, I really think they took the spirit of the historical lessons and worried less about accuracy. I do think that's an exception as well, right? Because the other reason I wanted to do that interview that I mentioned with the CNN reporter is because I had seen those TikToks before she showed me. And it is so rare that we get to see Latinos on screen speaking for themselves, not just portraying a housekeeper or day laborer or even having a speaking role. My university, USC, their communication school, USC Annenberg, has this big report on diversity. I think it's like the USC Annenberg Inclusion Report. And in the last 16 years, not much has changed in Hollywood. You know, even today, Latinos represent an average of 4% of speaking roles. If you look at somebody like Lupe Ontiveros, she played a housekeeper about 150 times. And to me, those TikTok videos are doing more than a lot of Hollywood productions are doing.
My next question is broad, and you can take it wherever you'd like to, but how many Los Angeleses do you think there are?
How many Angelinos do we have? One way I approach that question, just at a personal level, when people say they're coming to Los Angeles or that they have been and they didn't enjoy it, I always say, treat Los Angeles like just having a 6-mile radius around you. Do not try to go from one end of the county to the other. Nobody in Los Angeles does that unless it's a very important event. And then they give themselves an entire day. So within your 6-mile radius, you have a lot of diversity in there in every way, in terms of racial, ethnic, in terms of class, in terms of culinary, sometimes in terms of temperature, in all kinds of ways. But it really does feel like many LAs, depending on where you're from, where you grew up. I did this forum for the LA Times Book Festival a couple years back with my colleagues, George Sanchez, who had just written a book on Boyle Heights, and Pierre Hongdu Sotelo, who had written a book with Manuel Pastor on South LA. And I had my book, A Place at the Nayarit, had come out on Echo Park. And I think one of the lines from it was, in Los Angeles, Latinx identity can differ by zip code. So even Latino identity can differ so much, right? Because what I talk about in Echo Park is that it is a geographic crossroads, but it is also a cultural crossroads. What Miguel, Manuel, and Pierrette talk about in their South LA book is that Latino identity is shaped in relation to their Black neighbors. With George looking at Boyle Heights, what it meant to grow up and to see Mexicans displaced, repatriated, deported during the Depression, and then see the same thing happen to their Japanese neighbors during World War II. What does it mean when neighborhoods and populations are disposable? I had the privilege of being on a dissertation defense on Tuesday for one of our recent graduates, Julia Brown Bernstein, and she was looking at white identity and Latino identity. She looks at white identity, Latino identity, African-American identity in the Valley. But she starts her first chapter on white identity and Jewish identity and what it meant to move to the Valley versus the West Side if you were Jewish. And I'm like, you can do your own forum now, you know, how Jewish identity, how white identity differs in LA by zip code. So very much it's shaped by the transportation, your access of who gets to come into your neighborhood and who gets to leave, by your neighbors, by which generation you're in, all these kinds of things shape our identity.
Yeah, I was just talking about that on the podcast I mentioned before we started with Dorothy Lazard, and she spent time in the Western Addition and Fillmore District in San Francisco when she grew up. But a lot of the houses that were occupied by African-American families were actually there because Japanese had been interned during World War II, and then they moved in. And then you have, so these complicated histories of intersecting dynamics of who belongs, whose house is this, whose neighborhood is this, can change so rapidly. And you have conflict, but you also have a lot of cooperation. Based on what you were just talking about, I'm curious your perspective. We're going to talk about race and ethnicity here in just a second, but I'm curious, based on that history, do you think Angelenos have a unique perspective on race, given the complexity and diversity that is Los Angeles? Or do you think it is within keeping of broader understandings of race, whether regionally or nationally?
I think that's a great question. I think that's a question that I started to ask, and I knew other people were asking when I was in graduate school, because someone who was doing Latino studies, Latino history, and now there's a Latino studies organization, and there had been a Chicano studies organization. But for those of us doing history, we also wanted to be part of those conversations as well. And a lot of us ended up in the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association or in the Western History Association. And it was like, what does it mean that all these people doing Latino history are all in the West, right? And that's changed over time. And there were always some folks doing that kind of work, like in the Midwest, and they were like, don't forget us, we're here too. But it was interesting. And then a few years back, because a lot of my work on race is relational, this idea of what Mexican means, for example, is shaped by which groups are around there, with whether they be white or Black, Indigenous, Asian. And so we edited this volume called Relational Formations of Race. And I realized we needed to open it up and see what kind of work was being done out there, because a lot of the work that I knew was still on the West Coast. A lot of it in California, a lot of it in Southern California, a lot of it in LA. And I wanted it to be as geographically diverse as possible. So all these things speak to, yes, it does seem like people in Southern California, especially LA, can say something particular about this. That being said, when I was writing my book, my last book, A Place at the Nayarit on Echo Park, as I mentioned, I was talking about Echo Park being a geographic and cultural crossroads because there were, it's the home of the Mattachine Society, the first gay society. There are a lot of working class whites, a lot of whites in the art, in the arts. There are also a lot of white immigrants, but also then Latino immigrants and Asian immigrants. And then I interviewed a woman who had grown up in Chavez Ravine before it had been, the homes had been bought by the city under eminent domain and the neighborhood had been razed. And then once that happened, she moved into, I believe, Silver Lake and spent a lot of time in Echo Park. And she talked about how still post-war Boyle Heights was less diverse versus before. It was more diverse with more Jews and Japanese and European immigrants and became less diverse after World War II. And she talked about then teaching in East Los Angeles and going, the teachers having a meeting, and she invited some of the white teachers to somebody's house. And one of the other teachers told her, "I've never had a white person in my house." And this Latina was like, "What are you talking about? You're an adult. What are you talking about?" But she had grown up in Chavez Ravine and then Echo Park. So there is a way and still you, and that you still see some areas as more or less diverse. But yes, it is pretty amazing, those kinds of opportunities for coming together that just didn't happen in other places that are stratified because of tradition, stratified because of work histories, stratified because of lack of immigration. Here we're so close to the border, there's, and as well as to the Pacific Rim, that there is that kind of constant regeneration, and that, and hence a need to rethink who we are.
One last question before we jump into the meat of your books. I'm curious about your perspective as someone that works in K-12 about the ethnic studies rollout that's happening right now. The state is creating an ethnic studies requirement, and at least within our school district, they're piloting classes to think about ways to approach it. What's been interesting, at least within my school, is that there's a question about whether the ethnic studies class should be attached to the English department or the history department. So there's been a lot of ongoing discussion. It feels very much in early stages of conceptualizing how to implement it.
I think one thing to think about when, however we conceive of ethnic studies, especially for such broad populations in that way, and especially if it's going to be like one class that they take, is to figure out a way to put it more into the hands of the students. They love seeing themselves reflected in history. One of the things for my book, A Place at the Nayarit, that I've done is create curriculum around it. And that is about people being able to research, for example, their own neighborhoods, their own, what I call in the book, urban anchors, finding their place in history, teaching them how to do genealogical research. There's so many things that are so much easier now because of technology. And part of that comes from, I wrote this book and it was already my third book, and it's a public facing book, and I didn't need it for tenure, and I didn't have anything to prove. So I was like, I wrote it as a handbook of, I hope you do a project like this. This is how I see myself, my family reflected in history. And I try to write it in this way that was broader than that. But in essence, that is what is at the core, because I never saw people that look like me reflected in history books. But this is something that, you know, your average fourth grader can do by going down the street and asking a few questions of the person that runs the local bakery, panaderia, baklava shop, all these kinds of things. So I think there's a way to do that. This is something that I don't even realize that, I know that there are all these like culture wars around these kind of things, but just at the basic level of, people want to see themselves reflected in history and people can come up with those projects and present something. I don't see what's controversial about that. So I just came from a luncheon And there was a man there who had served in Vietnam in 1970 in the Marines. So he had volunteered in 1970, which says a lot about him given where Vietnam was in 1970. And he grew up in the house that had previously belonged to Edward Roybal, the first Latino city council member in Los Angeles. And next to Edward Roybal, and I'm forgetting his first name, was a veteran, Obregón, who received one of the special medals, one of the special honors for combat in Vietnam. And he didn't learn this until he was in, like, into adulthood. And he said that when you're in the Marines, you have to learn that Marine history. He said, in Vietnam, so many of my service brothers were black and brown, and so many were from East Los Angeles. Do you know what it would have meant for us to know that one of these decorated veterans had been one of us, and even from somewhere that we all knew? Just the joy of finding pride in seeing oneself reflected in history is huge. So, Joy, I think that it's wonderful that people are figuring out a way to get this curriculum across. But within that, and as things will sure to get controversial, I hope we don't forget that at the basic core is just people want to see themselves reflected in the larger story.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a few questions about each of your books. I want to start with Fit to Be Citizens. And I wanted to talk about public health and ideology for a second. In college and in grad school, I read Madness and Civilization, The History of Sexuality, and have thought about the way medical establishments can use power to create structures. But I'm curious, maybe if someone doesn't connect immediately, how a public health institution can develop and implement an ideology that has racism undergirding it. Like, how does that work in practice? If you could give an example.
Sure. First of all, I'll say that a lot of people don't make that connection, even public health officials.
Okay, all right.
When I first started working on this book, I got a lot of pushback because, of course, people in public health today are working really hard. I
And they're
mean,
heroes. Yeah, absolutely.
and they're
Yeah.
heroes. And so they were like, "What are you talking about? You're writing a book about this." Part of the book is understanding that none of us are somehow swimming outside of our societal cultural context. And if there are ideas influencing race, ethnicity, gender norms, that of course we may not be aware of them. If you look at somewhere like a time period like the early 20th century, which the book approaches, and that society is built on race as an organizing principle. Which, when you look at major national policies like and ideologies like Manifest Destiny, we shall go west and we shall take over these lands because indigenous peoples aren't using them as best as they can, and they would be better suited as settlements and have railroads running through it. Now we look at that and we're like, maybe that's a little problematic. But not even that long ago, we didn't. I grew up in the 70s with the Schoolhouse Rock videos where we explained, oh, Manifest Destiny might just need a little more elbow room. So it was certainly something I didn't question for a long time. And if I said that people like real estate agents and land developers were also thinking that they knew how to use this land better and who should inhabit it, we probably wouldn't really doubt that. But there's a way in which we think of science as so objective that's different, right? And yet we see the ways that public health officials went in and said, hey, we're going to put in more clinics over here, less clinics over there. And these clinics are going to teach people, like immigrants, like Mexican immigrants, how to be good mothers, what food to give their children, how to take care of them in terms of their health. And this is because their culture is not as evolved as ours. We don't think about it that much if it's a teacher putting, we're not surprised if it's a teacher in the early 20th century, maybe putting a dance camp on a child that doesn't know English and is a monolingual Spanish speaker, or a social worker who is coming in. But somehow we think that public health officials should be immune from that. So it's a way of just saying, wait a minute, this racial ideology guided all the people that lived during this time period. And what we also see is that Latinos then in the second generation, who then want to remove themselves from the stigma of that is often attached to the first generation of immigrants, might also have some of these internalized beliefs as well. And so that's also how you see it's not that it's a racial ideology that means that these folks were racist, but simply part of the belief system of the time.
Yeah, it feels like the history of eugenics in California is just unrepresented in terms of books that I see on the bookshelves and learning more about it. What's your perspective on the state getting involved and trying to compensate for some of these wrongs?
I think sometimes we have the sense that like this major revision will happen if the state's involved, and all of a sudden like it's going to upset the apple cart. But oftentimes those standards have to be, are so strict, have to be proven and all this. So to me, it's more that it moves the conversation forward and gets these topics out of the darkness. And again, this is, forget even going back to the gold rush. I live in Los Angeles. We had sterilizations here passed when it was legal in the LA County Hospital, which is now where my university has their hospital, the USC Keck Medical Center, and the LA County Hospital is still there, but Keck surrounds it. And people that work at Keck, people that work in LA County at the LA County Hospital, don't know that sterilizations happen there. And this has been material that's, there was a court case around it in the 70s. And so it's been public knowledge all this time. And then luckily, Virginia Espino wrote a dissertation on it and turned it into an award-winning documentary along with an award-winning filmmaker. And it's called No Más Bebés, No More Babies, right? No More Sterilization. So I've been teaching this subject for 24 years now. And every time I teach it, like barely any student in the class knows about it, including the ones that grew up in that area. Again, it was based in this case, not on the sterilizations, not on eugenics as we think about it in terms of the originating ideas around eugenics, but population control and linked with ideas about welfare, and that these ideas can seep into who birth control is pushed on versus given as a choice versus what kind of birth control they get. So in all kinds of ways, these issues continue to be eerily present. And that by understanding the past, it might inform us of, about how we might move forward in the future and therefore are necessary.
I also very much enjoyed your book, How Race is Made. Can you explain what a racial script is? I found it such a useful concept to understand, and I think it could be a tool because, as you mentioned in the book, these still are, racial scripts are being used constantly today.
A racial script is the idea that how a racial category is formed is informed by those around them or not around them, even if they don't exist in the same moment in time. When we think about, for example, Latinos, I'm interviewing Hector Tobar next week for his beautiful book, Our Migrant Souls. And we're still, I think the flyer says, what is a Latino? Is it a race or ethnicity? It's still this question that we're debating, where as if we look at the category Mexican, for example, which predates Latino, Mexicans were admitted into the US as US citizens. Why? Because the U.S. and Mexico had gone to war and they came up with a treaty when they ended the war, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. So it's a legal document that says, okay, war's over. The U.S., we're going to take 1/3 of Mexico's land. We know some Mexicans are living here. Okay, we're going to give them citizenship. The problem is that citizenship is really defined by whiteness at the time. Whites are the only ones that can become citizens. Indigenous groups that were here before whites, they can't become citizens. African Americans are either slaves or at the very least not citizens. And Asian immigrants, who Chinese immigrants who have come to work on the railroads, they also aren't citizens. So in a sense, Mexicans are both legal citizens, but really not socially and culturally accepted. Because that notion of who is accepted as a citizen is defined by all those other groups. So if you fast forward to today, when we still debate, you know, should Latinos automatically become citizens if they're born here, but their parents are not and are undocumented? Are these groups considered what some would call anchor babies, that they're coming here just to get citizenship for their parents? This is a debate that's not just shaped by the politics of today, but can go back all the way to the 1850s, because it's a question that's never settled. It's a script that kind of keeps moving down the road.
And I was thinking as I was reading your book about government policy, people's beliefs, people's actions, and how those interact with each other.
Yeah, that is always part of the fascinating thing, right? The first chapter that I wrote in the book, I think there's a good example in that chapter, which is I found this file at the National Archives, because what happens in 1850 is Mexicans are allowed legal citizenship. Then in 1924, we have the passage of the 1924 Immigration Act that puts quotas on limits, basically numerical limits on which groups can immigrate into the US. Mexican, and so they put quotas on immigrants from like Eastern Europe, quotas on Great Britain as well, but much higher quotas, but no quotas on Mexicans, because employers, large-scale employers on the West Coast argued against it because they wanted that ready supply of labor that they did not have to pay a lot of money for. But then they also banned then Asian immigrants. And so there becomes this attitude of, wait a minute, is it really fair to not allow the Italian in, but to continue to allow the Mexican in? What are ways that we might define them as non-white, and therefore they also wouldn't be eligible for citizenship? And so they're looking and looking for a test case, which they finally get, and which does not come to fruition in terms of making them ineligible. But in the meantime, what you get is you find these anti-immigrationists going through different court cases. And so you see all the letters that people are writing in. It's not the government dictating to this person in Kansas City how to think about race. It's that person from Kansas City writing into the government saying, hi, we just got these new neighbors. They're from Mexico. Not quite sure how to think about them. They're not, their skin doesn't look like mine. It is more tawny colored. Am I supposed to treat them like blacks, or are they more like Native American? Tell me what I should be doing here, right? So you see this kind of flowing in all kinds of directions. Same thing in my book, Fit to Be Citizens. There I look at records to the city council. It's your everyday citizen, Nellie Duncan, writing into the city council saying, not sure if you're aware, but I have these Mexican neighbors and I'd like you to come check out this situation. So it's this ebb and flow for both. I was just at this luncheon, and this man who grew up in Edward Roybal's house, I said, do you know the story of that house? He said, what are you talking about? I said, they weren't going to sell Edward Roybal that house, because Edward Roybal was the city councilman. He needed this house in this district, but they did not want to sell to him because he was Mexican. Right. So it's a government law, but it's the real estate agent who is telling him you're not allowed to buy this house. So you see this kind of complicated dance all around, and power flowing from the top down, but from the bottom up to their neighbors. And yes, it's a much more complicated picture than we think about in terms of the government telling us what to think.
Let's jump to your most recent book, which is beautiful in so many ways. I have my favorite restaurants that I like to go to and understand, at least in a limited way. I'm not an immigrant. We all are immigrants, but I'm not a recent immigrant to the United States. And I want you to talk, if you can, about how writing this book was different, given its intimacy with your family. And then if you could share why in the Latino community or in immigrant communities more broadly?
Sure. I've been fortunate to be teaching for over 20 years now, but when I got the idea for the book, I'd wanted to tell the story for a long time, but there was that part of me that felt like it's a family story, right? It's a personal story. And I wasn't quite sure how to do it. I didn't know if people would be interested. And this goes back to your original question. My imagination was, in a sense, limited by the fact that I thought about what literature was out there. And I didn't have a kind of second generation Chicano story to tell for this time period. And I didn't have a farm worker story to tell. And these are like two major ways of thinking about this time period or how we thought about these time periods. And then I got to the point where I was like, wait a minute, we don't have the story. And from teaching history and urban studies and ethnic studies and seeing that we didn't quite have this kind of story, I thought, oh, that means we need to tell it. Okay. And then luckily by then I'd written a couple of books so that I knew how to get a shard of evidence and contextualize it in such a way that it could tell a larger story of the time period, of the place, of immigration, of all these kinds of dynamics. So in a sense, academia did that kind of restriction that you were talking about. And when I first started writing the book, I tried in different ways. I did try to do it mainly as a memoir. And there are wonderful examples out there by wonderful historians like Richard White's book about his mother. I tried to do it as a food history. And there's so many good works, especially in Asian American studies, on food and how food tells us something about how society views immigrants and how immigrants try to make their place in society. And then that didn't work for me. As someone who's worked a long time in urban studies and ethnic studies and is really interested in how race and place come together, I did then want to tell it as this fuller history that then also has things like footnotes in it. Because like I said, I wanted people to also be able to replicate the work, because everybody has a favorite restaurant. And there are so many immigrant stories. And I wanted people to give that kind of model. My grandmother started the restaurant called the Nayarit. And growing up, I knew that our family had something that I didn't quite see everywhere else. And I certainly didn't see reflected in the history books. And that was this kinship that came from that place, this fictive kinship that developed not in the way that we talk about fictive kinship for Latinos in terms of religious ceremonies like baptism or first communion or marriage, but from place. It was a place-based kinship, both from where they were from in Mexico and also what they created here in the United States. And so I thought this would be one way to tell the story. And I'll refer to this luncheon I just came from. There was this amazing person there who had grown up in East LA. And so I went and talked to him. I'm like, I'm going to interview you after this. This is so amazing. So one of the things he was telling me about was one of the neighbors in Boyle Heights who owned Simon's Brickyard. And Simon's Brickyard was like a company town, right? And so I was telling him the story of when I first started writing the book, people were like, yeah, but a restaurant. Is it a democratic space? Because it's not a public space. Like, I get that usually when we talk about a place that like all immigrants would be welcome, you're thinking of a public space, a park, a beach. But in truth, those spaces, especially in the 40s, 50s, 60s that I'm talking about in this restaurant, they're segregated. And so even if you look at somewhere like a public pool, it's segregated. They in Los Angeles that people think about, they think about segregation as being relegated to the South. In Los Angeles, public pools, the only time Mexicans could go to the public pool was the day before the pool was drained, because there was this belief that they were dirty. And so I'd given this book talk, and this man who'd grown up in one of the Simon Brickyards facilities in LA in Montebello, he said that when his dad and his friend would go to the public pool the day before it was drained, that they would cover themselves in the brick dust so that when they jumped in the pool, they would turn the water brown and say, there, you wanted us to be dirty Mexicans? You got it. And so to me, it was like, here's this space that countered so many of the other spaces that workers walked into. Here was a space that, while not a traditional public space, right, because it's an economic actor, it's a restaurant, that people felt that they could walk into, be themselves, speak in Spanish, and belong. And on top of that, have the food that connected them to home. What can be better than that?
One of the things that comes up in your book is gentrification, which this is a complicated story in a lot of ways. Are you pretty fatalistic in terms of where you think we're going with gentrification? I had a family member who lives in the Riverside area, and he was sending me Zillow links, and I was like, good God, for Riverside? And from your perspective, how do you think about where we're going?
That's a good point. I think at a basic level, one does think about supply and demand, right? There's this great line in The Sopranos where Tony Soprano tells his son, AJ, buy land. They're not making any more of it. And it just seems like for LA, there is that scarcity that, as much as people are trying these different models, and you don't hear of that many models that are being tried, right? There's this bakery in Atwater Proof. It's lovely, where they were going to sell it and they sold it to the employees and did it, made sure everybody had a share so that they could participate in that. Roy Choi, the chef who's from LA and loves LA, and I think so many of his businesses are a love letter to LA. He ends up opening in Chinatown to try to give Chinatown a boost. What does that do? It helps gentrify it. Josefina Lopez, the author of the playwright, a beautiful writer who wrote Real Women Have Curves. She's from Boyle Heights. She loves Boyle Heights. Instead of buying this big home for herself, she invests in her theater. What does that do? It brings more artists. It helps gentrify it. So one does wonder about those kinds of limits in terms of, as rent control goes away, which it does once somebody moves out of that apartment and automatically the rent goes up a huge percent if they've been living in that apartment a long time, that the landlord can raise it. It's the rents, not just the buying that's impossible, it's even the renting. So at that level, I think it's really difficult. But at the very least, I think we have to have a sense of what was there before us, and that we are changing things, whether we want to or not. I sometimes tell myself, I keep hearing about that restaurant. I don't want to go. I know it's gentrifying that neighborhood. And eventually I'll go there and I'm like, gosh, gentrification tastes good, right? And there are people that are like trying to live their best lives by honoring the farm to table movement, by paying decent wages, like all these kinds of things. Like, these projects sometimes are at loggerheads with one another, which is so difficult. But yeah, there's certainly no easy answer around that.
I want to ask you just two broad questions about California history. This is a California History podcast. So through your research, how has your understanding of California's history evolved? If you think about the course of your career and the research that you've been building upon, how has it evolved? How has it changed?
No one's ever asked me that. That's a great question. I guess I'm reminded of your earlier question of how many Los Angeleses are there. And for California history, it just seems that there are so many stories to be told and so many stories about that help us understand what belonging means, how people shape belonging, how that shaping of belonging is not just at an individual level, but it's institutional and structural and shaped by what came before it. And that we must have an understanding of that in order to move forward. You must get this a lot when I get this a lot, if I get introduced at a party, as I was just recently, oh, Natalia teaches history. And then you get the, it must be hard since the humanities are dying kind of question. And I promise I hadn't even finished my first margarita, but for whatever reason, I just decided not to participate in that framework. And I said, what is hard? I shudder at thinking of a time when people aren't reading books, so that they can understand worlds and cultures and the past to think of something larger than themselves and to imagine a better world. Yes, that would be hard not to have the humanities.
Yeah, I would maybe be a little bit more combative and say that I'm bullish on the humanities. And I think that just because the typical gatekeepers are not going to be the ones in control doesn't mean the humanities are not going to still have a role in our culture. I do want to close with my favorite place, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Okay. I've already mentioned George Sanchez's book on Boyle Heights, Manuel Pastor and Pierrot Hamdou-Sautel's book on South Central, a book that I love in terms of California, which I'm sure you've probably interviewed her, is Miriam Powell's The Browns of California. And I mention it because in the not too distant future, she'll have a book on the UC system.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, she has a preternatural ability to take one family story, one institution story, and tell this larger story of the state, which I think is commendable. We are blessed in LA to have Kelly Lado Hernandez as a historian at UCLA, and her book on the Magón brothers on Mexico as being at the heart of a US empire. And her new book is amazing. So I'll remind you of her last book, City of Inmate, on conquest, rebellion, and on City of Inmates, Conquest, Rebellion, and the Rise of Human Caging in LA. Because this is one of those kind of layered history stories and one that's relational as well, looking at Chinese, looking at Mexicans, and really ending with African, or looking at, she looks at indigenous Chinese, Mexicans, and the story of incarceration doesn't really come until the end of the book for African Americans, which is, I think, where people usually start. Also, Californian, Professor Dylan Penningroth at Berkeley, who just wrote this beautiful book, Before the Movement, The Hidden History of Black Civil Rights. And he really writes that as a popular press book, starting with his family's history, and one in which, in order to tell this history, he had to go through the records of individual courthouses, getting into their base. As a professor, he had the privilege then of having a team of researchers, of students to work with. Really just a beautifully told book as well.
Yeah. Okay. Two final questions before I let you go. First, what are you working on next? And the second one, if you and I were driving through LA and stopped at a random taqueria, what would be your order?
The first question is, I started writing a lot of this work at the Huntington Library. It's still a place that I love to go to. I think of it as a WeWorks for intellectuals. It's a kind of place where you can go have a coffee and your favorite historian who you've never met is there, and you can say, this is what I'm working on. But I started as a grad student, and I invited my dad to have lunch with me one day. And my dad was a Mexican immigrant, eighth grade education. And he said, oh, this place is gorgeous, the gardens, everything. You must love working here. And I said, I do, and it's a privilege. It can also be a little intimidating and isolating when you're the only person of color, only Latina in the big Harry Potter like reading room. And he leaned across the table and he looked at me in the eye and he said, why would you ever be intimidated? We built this place. Referring to that 100 years ago, Mexican immigrants were doing so much of the manual labor and we had probably built it. And I always thought, it always stuck with me, but I thought, how would I ever tell that story? And lo and behold, I'm figuring out a way to tell it now. So I'm working on this history of the Huntington Library, which is much more than a Mexican immigrant story, I'm realizing. It's a German immigrant. It's an indigenous story. It's a Chinese immigrant story. So again, that kind of layering. And I just had this, I realized in terms of my taco order, one, again, I'm place-based, so it depends where I am in the city and what I'm in the mood for. And I don't even just mean in terms of food, even in terms of region. I lived in San Diego for a lot of years now, so I am always on the hunt for a good fish taco. So going somewhere like Ricky's Fish Tacos, but we're from the state of Nayarit. So going to get like a good ceviche tostada. But the one thing probably that has stayed with me from living in San Diego is because it was so close to the border is they put guacamole in their tacos, whereas you did that a lot more in LA now, but they did it before. And so my favorite is Villa's Tacos. They have one in Highland Park, and they just opened one in Grand Central Market. And this is, I call him a kid because he's a young guy, a kid who's got just great second generation immigrant hustle and is a Dodger fan. So hopefully the Dodgers don't hear this and shut him down because his sign is like, it looks like the Dodger insignia, like catching a fly ball or something, but instead taco. Really. So.
That's fantastic. I personally look for a Trumbo and that al pastor. I always hope when I bite into it, I'm going to get a small piece of pineapple, maybe if I'm lucky, but that's my usual. Dr. Molina, thank you so much for doing this. And what's the full title of your newest book?
A Place at the Nayarit, How a Mexican Restaurant Nourished a Community. And thank you for such a thorough, thoughtful, careful interview. Your students are really lucky to have you, as are we.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. ¶¶